You're listening to Defending Faith, Family, and Freedom, featuring Gary Bauer, Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute. And now, here's Gary.
Hi, this is Gary Bauer, Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Culture at the James Dobson Family Institute. Welcome to our podcast, Defending Faith, Family, and Freedom. I'm glad you're with us. Please continue to tell your friends about us and tune in regularly. Well, just going through another tumultuous period of time in America in 2026. My wife Carol and I were relaxing over the weekend. Our phones started dinging, and we got the news that there had been an assassination attempt, another assassination attempt, on President Trump at the Washington Hilton Hotel. And later that evening, after we reassured ourselves that family members and friends that work either with the president or adjacent to the president were okay, and that the course that President Trump and the First Lady and the cabinet was able to escape any harm, I found myself, before the day was over, doing a little bit of having a flashback, I guess is the right word for it. Because in March of 1981, wow, it's almost like talking about the 1800s. March of 1981, that seems like an awfully long time ago. There was another assassination attempt at the Washington Hilton Hotel. I was a low-level staffer at the time, working in the old executive office building in the Reagan administration. Many of you know that I had spent a good bit of my adult life, after hearing Ronald Reagan give a speech in the 1964 presidential election for Barry Goldwater, some would say foolishly, decided that I was going to work for Ronald Reagan someday and that he was going to be president of the United States. And I won't bore you with all the twists and turns, but in 1981, at the very beginning of his administration, I had reached that lifelong dream. I had a very, very, very low-level job, but I was working for Ronald Reagan, and I was in the White House complex, the campus that includes the old executive office building. Later, I would get an opportunity to serve Reagan at a much higher level, actually in the White House itself. But on this day, March 30th, 1981, I had this low-level position. I was returning to my office after being on Capitol Hill. As I was being driven back to my office, there were sirens all over Washington, D.C., and I wondered whether there was a riot going on or some other kind of civil unrest. And then I saw multiple police cars going up Connecticut Avenue. And it suddenly hit me that President Reagan had a speech at the Washington Hilton Hotel to part of the AFL-CIO, a union. And the thought crossed my mind, did something happen to the president? Later, when I went to my office and got in the elevator to ride up to the floor I was on, and the elevator doors opened. The doors opened across from the office of the Vice President of the United States, and there were two men standing there with machine guns. So I knew that, yes, indeed, whatever happened at the hotel was involving President Reagan. My heart sunk. Ronald Reagan gave this speech to the AFL-CIO. It's very early in his first term as president. He's leaving the Washington Hilton Hotel. And as he leaves, he's passing a crowd. And in the crowd is a guy named John Hinckley. Hinckley was able to fire six shots at President Ronald Reagan in that circular area right outside the hotel. The first bullet hit Press Secretary James Brady. I had shared an office with James Brady in the campaign. He was now in the position of the president's press secretary. The wound that James Brady suffered would change his life and his family's lives forever. The bullet exploded in his brain. He suffered severe brain damage. He was confined to a wheelchair the rest of his life. The second bullet hit a District of Columbia police officer. The third bullet hit a window across the street from the hotel. The fourth bullet hit a Secret Service agent, Timothy McCarthy. The fifth bullet hit the window of the limousine, the presidential limousine. The sixth bullet hit the limousine itself and ricocheted into President Reagan. After the shots were fired, and it seemed like it took forever when you watched a videotape, a Secret Service agent shoved President Reagan into the limousine and told the driver to head to the White House. Get us out of here now, to the White House, to the White House. The agent kept asking President Reagan, "Are you hurt? Were you hit?" And Reagan said, no, I'm fine. The only thing that's wrong is you hit my knee when you pushed me into the car." And then the Secret Service agent, looking at Reagan, saw on Reagan's lips some spittle, some moisture, and the color was red. And that Secret Service agent realized immediately that the president was seriously injured. He ordered the driver, head to George Washington Hospital. Reagan objected. "No, I want to go back to the White House." "Mr. President, you've been hit. Get him to George Washington Hospital." If that Secret Service agent had not insisted on getting to that hospital right away, all of history would have been changed. Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump share a couple of characteristics, and one of them is they don't want to give up. Neither of them want to give up. Reagan didn't want to give up. Trump doesn't want to give up. And so they get Reagan into the hospital. He collapses in the lobby. He's immediately tended to, brought into an operation room. He's still conscious. And then a number of things happen, one of which is that Ronald Reagan, even under these just horrible circumstances, the Reagan humor showed through. They're getting ready to put Reagan under for the surgery because when they took his jacket and clothes off, they saw a hole in his body underneath his arm. The bullet had penetrated his chest, was in his lung, just a half inch or so away from his heart. President Reagan looks at the doctors gathered around his bedside, and he says, "Well, I sure hope you all are Republicans." One of the doctors, Dr. Giordano, replied, "Today, Mr. President, we're all Republicans." Dr. Giordano was a staunch Democrat. The America of 1981 was a different America than what we're living through now. The surgery lasted 2 hours. The bullet was removed. It had bounced off one of President Reagan's ribs. The president was able to return to the White House 11 days later. When all this news got back to the White House complex, as I said, that's where I worked at the time, we were all on the edge of our seat. The reports were all over the place. It was hard to get information. It was hard to get information even if you were Ed Meese, who was one of Ronald Reagan's top assistants and advisors. At one point, we got a report that President Reagan had died on the operating table. That same report went out around the country briefly, and we saw when that happened a little bit of the road we were on, the road we're clearly on now. Even back in 1981, there were reports in urban schools that when they announced over the loudspeaker that President Reagan had been shot and had likely died, in some classrooms, applause broke out. Not just in one or two schools, but many schools over urban America. Already we were beginning to see the hate that has continued to grow and fester, just as we see it now every day. Well, Ronald Reagan survived that horrible wound, that horrible assault on him, and he concluded that the only reason he survived, that the bullet would so nearly miss his heart that the Secret Service agent would overrule Ronald Reagan and order the limousine to the hospital, that the surgeons would be some of the best surgeons in the country, that they were able to extract the bullet before Ronald Reagan would die from the injury. Reagan decided that he was saved because God had something else for him to do. Now, just a few months later, Pope John Paul II was in St. Peter's Square when a radical Islamist fired multiple shots. One of the shots hit Pope John Paul, almost killing him. Pope John Paul would recover from those injuries, and he would tell confidants there was something else God wanted him to do. And then a few years later, on October 12, 1984, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher of Britain, Great Britain, was nearly blown up in a terrorist attack at a hotel by the Irish Republican Army that set off a bomb that caused the hotel partially to collapse. Margaret Thatcher was in the bathroom of her suite and walked out of it just seconds before floors above her collapsed and buried the bathroom that she had been standing in. Margaret Thatcher thought fate still had something for her to do. And so these three individuals, Ronald Reagan, Pope John Paul, and Margaret Thatcher, worked together to bring down Soviet communism. Reagan had said very earlier in his career in a major speech, the one that I heard that led me want to work for him, that the world could not remain half slave, communist, and half free, living the way we did in the United States. He said ultimately either slavery or freedom would prevail. There was no middle ground, and that it was essential that freedom prevail or the world would sink into another dark age. Well, the rest is history, of course. I remember in the years that I worked inside the White House as Reagan and Thatcher and Pope John Paul worked together in this game of chess around the world, that periodically in a meeting in the cabinet room, the president would get some great news where we had outmaneuvered the Soviet Union in some way. We had gotten ourselves into a better position, and one of his first reactions would be, get Maggie on the phone, the nickname of Margaret Thatcher. And the president, filled with delight, would tell the prime minister what had just happened. So let's come up to present time. As I said, that Carol and I were watching TV when the news came about the assassination attempt on the president. And as I said, I couldn't help but remember what had happened at that same hotel. You know, the shooting at Saturday's White House Correspondents' Dinner at the Washington Hilton was at least the third known attempt to kill President Trump since 2016. Actually, there are two other attempts that don't get much publicity. So if you go back to 2016, it's actually the fifth attempt. If you go from the time he started running, beginning in 2022 until now, there were three attempts. And of course, these are not the only acts of violence committed by unhinged leftists. Some of this leftist violence has many motives, many causes that it's promoting. There's violence by Marxists and socialists, by haters of Judeo-Christian civilization, by transgender lunatics, by radical Islamists, and by the radicalized base of the Democrat Party. Some of the motivations overlap with each other, but they account for the vast majority of the political violence in the United States of America. From attacks on synagogues and Christian schools to the assassination of corporate CEOs and ambushes of law enforcement officers. When violent leftist attacks occur, there is a powerful infrastructure that will cover for them, make excuses for them. They'll blame it on the growth of mental illness in America, or they will even blame it on Donald Trump himself, the chosen target of these attacks. I became infuriated in the wake of the attack at the White House correspondents' dinner when some commentators on Fox News said the violent rhetoric on both sides has got to stop. There is no both sides, period. The vast majority of political violence is coming from one side, the left. Saying both sides makes it impossible to deal with the growing problem of left-wing violence. Now, I couldn't help but notice that President Trump reacted Saturday evening in much the same way as he did at Butler, Pennsylvania. Secret Service agents at the Butler rally pushed then-candidate Trump down on the stage to protect him. But Trump fought to get back up on his feet to reassure people there and those watching at home on TV that he had not been killed or seriously wounded. He then yelled the famous line, "Fight, fight, fight." Many people believe that incident and his bravado propelled him into the White House. And now at this attack at the dinner for the reporters and all the chaos that was taking place, the Secret Service agents with their weapons drawn, if you watch the videos, President Trump was calm and in charge. In fact, he didn't want the White House Correspondents' Dinner to be canceled Saturday night. He wanted the show to go on. When asked about the fact later that this was the third attempt on his life since the Butler rally, Trump replied that danger comes with the job, and he was not going to live in fear. He also noted that consequential presidents, presidents who are doing something important, who are accomplishing a lot, were the ones most often targeted by their violent opponents. They don't go after the ones who don't do much, Trump said in his usual brusque way. But he's right. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated by a Southern sympathizer furious that Lincoln had freed the slaves. We're still debating what motivated Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin of John F. Kennedy, but there was no doubt that John F. Kennedy was on the way to becoming an historic president. While John Hinckley Jr. thought that killing Ronald Reagan would impress a movie star, the left in America hated Reagan, and Hinckley had reason to believe that more than the movie star would applaud what he was trying to do. Watching videos from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I noticed something that was encouraging, and with all this dark talk about deaths and assassinations, let me at least mention this one bright spot to you. A number of men could be seen protecting their wives and girlfriends at the dinner, putting their own bodies over theirs, or shielding them from the direction the shots were coming. It reminded me of the husband and father in Butler, Pennsylvania, who used his own body to shield and protect his wife and daughter and ended up taking several bullets and dying from his injuries, but he protected his family. Now, you know, I've said it before, you probably have read it, just like Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul and Margaret Thatcher thought that their lives had been saved because there was something else they were supposed to do. I know from personal conversations after the president's survival at Butler, Pennsylvania, and in various meetings I've been in with other people and the president, that President Trump believes God has saved his life because God has other things he wants President Trump to do. And I believe that's true. And I suspect, although I have not seen the president since this latest assassination plot, that he probably has even been reinforced to believe that he was saved again, as were members of his cabinet, because they're doing God's work. Well, there's a lot to think about here, and wrap it up with something I, again, suspect you may not want to hear. I mean, I've run into people, some of them close to me, who just say, Gary, I can't take it anymore. All of this constant outrage and controversy and yelling and fighting, we can't take it anymore. We've just got to get away from the battle. We just got to move on. I know a lot of you also believe and hope and pray that the country can just come together. And I guess this is the heavy part of the message, my friends. I don't believe there's any possibility of the country coming together. Dr. Dobson and I wrote about this many years ago when we wrote the book Children at Risk, The Battle for the Hearts and Minds of Our Children. The divisions in America are irreconcilable. Only one side will ultimately prevail. The growing socialist Islamic alliance in America wants government to control everything. It wants religious liberty restricted, more babies aborted, and more transgendered children. We believe that life is sacred and that our liberty comes from God. We want our children to be protected, not mutilated. We don't want people coming into the country if they don't broadly share our Judeo-Christian worldview. What is the common ground between these two belief systems? Where are we supposed to compromise? Christians and the church cannot be neutral in the culture war just for the sake, the vain sake of having peace. Appeasement always fails. You may not like politics. You may not like the nastiness of the battle that's going on. But a decision to withdraw from the battle is not just a decision that will impact you. You're deciding, if you withdraw from the battle, the kind of country your children and grandchildren will inherit. I'll put a sharper point on it. You're making a decision if you withdraw that your children and grandchildren will end up living on their knees, directed by forces that are opposed to everything we believe in. If you make a decision that we're going to fight, then there's a chance your children and grandchildren will live as free men and women. You will have risen to the occasion as previous generations have. So don't give up. Be on your knees only to pray. And then let the events of recent days charge you up again to fight the good fight for faith, freedom, and family. God bless you, my friends. Tune in again.
Subscribe to Gary Bauer's Defending Faith, Family, and Freedom, where you find your favorite podcasts. Just hit the subscribe button to ensure you receive every episode.